Out here on the edge of the world, paths aren't always paths and roads aren't always roads. And some of us just get to where we're going a little bit of a different way. Today we're going to talk about, well, we're going to talk about the church. But we ain't going to church the way that most people get there. Today we're going to be talking to Miss Angelique Gibson, a different kind of woman who walks a different kind of path out here in Outlandish Parish. We were having this conversation because I reached out to look for somebody who was raised Catholic. Myself personally, look, I was an altar girl. I'm going to consider us around the same age. There was a brief moment in like the late 80s, early 90s where they did allow altar girls. I went to a Catholic elementary school. So you were raised Catholic as well down in Church Point?
No. In New Roads.
New Roads. Sorry.
In Pointe Coupee. Yeah, I was raised Catholic. I would say New Roads is probably 99% Catholic. Especially back in the late 70s, early 80s when I was a little kid.
Yeah, I mean, New Roads and Cutoff can't be that dissimilar from what I hear about it.
Probably not. They're pretty good ways apart geographically.
In our front yard. Yeah, but I mean, culturally, like, New Roads isn't...
It's the same. Yes, it's the same. Everyone I knew was Catholic. I was Catholic. My dad is still a practicing Catholic, member of the Knights of Columbus, sings in the choir. Catholic. And I went to Catholic school from kindergarten through ninth grade and went to church every Sunday. I was in the CYO.
Like playing volleyball, doing the ways of the cross, the whole night.
Yes. You know what? That's really funny. My son-in-law was here this morning. He was talking about how his mom and her mother were doing the ways of the cross this weekend. And I was like, oh, I hated that. I remember hating that so much. I was so bored.
And there is all this like pageantry. There's this pomp and circumstance. I got to be honest, being raised Catholic has made me eternally a church snob. If you don't have stained glass, like, what are you even doing here? You know?
Right. And I was very judgy of other people's churches too. So I have family in Ville Platte, and our church in New Roads was so much prettier than their church in Ville Platte too.
I remember the first time I went to, like, we were pretty poor coming up. So in the summertime, we went to like every vacation Bible school because it was free daycare. So even though my mother never went to a non-Catholic service, including funerals or weddings, until she was, I mean, I had kids. She was in her 50s before she ever went to a non-Catholic church service. We went to like all the weird churches because they gave us free daycare in the summertime. And the first time I went to a church that had an electric guitar and was like, used to be a gas station, I didn't even know where we were. I'm like, there's no Eucharist, there's no kneeling, there's an electric guitar. What even is this? Like, I was so out of my depth.
I had a friend when I was 10 years old. Our parents were friends. I had gone to school with her since kindergarten. Her mom had an in-home preschool. And she was like every kid in the area's like second mom. They were Baptist, but although they both went to Catholic school. But anyway, when we were in fifth grade, they pulled them out of Catholic school and they joined the new church in New Roads, which was I don't think it was exactly Pentecostal, but it was an evangelical church. And like, they couldn't play with us on the weekends anymore. They couldn't go to birthday parties. They couldn't really be friends with us because we didn't go to their church. Like, they kept to themselves completely. And we were all like very, very taken aback by that. Like, what is this? What's going on here? Then shortly after that, her mom died and she had meningitis. She got meningitis. She got a headache, went to take a nap and never woke up again. And so we all went to the funeral. And here we are, a bunch of 10-year-old girls at this evangelical church funeral. And people were like talking in tongues. We were crying because we were sad. And they were like, no, you can't cry. This is a happy day. And there was a lot of, you know, there were people like rolling around on the floor and we were like, what the hell is going on here? Like, I still remember to this day being in that church for that funeral and thinking, I have never seen anything like this in my entire life.
Like when my mom talks me into going to mass with her, even these days, like in my head, I'll say the words that I agree with in any given prayer and then not say the words that I don't.
I have to do that with the Pledge of Allegiance. So I get it.
Yeah. You know, when we talk about like the Catholicism of our youth, it was so present. And I think in Cajun culture, you know, the reason we're covering this is because up until I think our childhood, when, you know, a lot more people had moved in from out of the predominantly Cajun areas to come and work here through the oil field and through various industries, to be Cajun was to be Catholic.
Yes, you know, for sure.
The reason all the bridges down here are where the churches are. It's a very closely identified thing. And when you find our generation, for those of us who still think of ourselves as Cajun, but maybe don't follow the faith of our families and the faith of our ancestors or the mythologies and beliefs of our bloodlines in perpetuity, as far as we can trace back, you know, it's kind of an interesting thing to see that I still consider myself Cajun, even if like I don't go up and receive the Eucharist.
I am in that same place. I definitely still identify as a Cajun person. It was what my childhood was. I was steeped in it. Everything we did was really in some way or another tied into the Catholic Church. I was very, as a child, invested in Catholicism. My greatest joy in life was singing in the youth choir, Bible school in the summers, and everything that we were talking about. It was very much a part of my identity. But I also had this other part of me that kind of tugged and pulled. I had things that I believed that I really didn't have words for at the time and wouldn't have words for it into adulthood. I was always really, I guess, obsessed with more of the creepier things. And I stripped our poor little Catholic school library and our poor little New Roads library of any books that had anything to do with the supernatural, anything spooky or creepy.
That's so funny. I came to the knowledge of that through the library as well. Like, oddly enough, our Catholic school library had like a really good section on the Salem witch trials and herbal medicine.
Really? Really? Yeah. Ours did not. And I was very precocious, and I was a very early reader. And so by the time I was in fourth and fifth grade, I was reading adult books. And so I can remember going to the library and trying to check out Rosemary's Baby. And I was probably no older than about 10 or 11 years old. And the librarian was a family friend, and she wouldn't let me have it. Even though my mom had said it was okay, the librarian would not let me have the book. And I was mad. Oh, I was so mad. So I had this other part of me that I never really talked about with anybody else, not because I was ashamed of it, but because I thought it was weird that I was so obsessed with these things, and that there were things that I saw and that I believed that I really just couldn't put any explanation to. But also, my mom was very much a feminist. And I grew up the oldest of three sisters. And so we had a very feminine oriented household, much to my dad's chagrin. As I learned more, I guess, in religion class, I would question why women were so subservient to men in church. And you talked about altar girls. And I actually wrote a letter to the bishop in Baton Rouge asking why girls couldn't be altar girls, because that wasn't allowed at that time. And that was in the sixth grade. I was in the sixth grade, and I actually got a response through my religion teacher, and she read it out loud to the class about how women had their place in the church and we had our roles, and women were equal to men but different.
Oh, wow. I don't know why we could have altar girls and y'all couldn't. I mean, I guess it was sixth grade, so there was some sort of shift not too long after. Maybe you wrote that letter, and maybe you're the reason I was allowed to be an altar girl.
Maybe.
I don't know.
That would make my little heart happy. But That was at the point where I really started to become uninvested. I was like, this is bull, and I'm not standing for this. So I really started to really become uninvested in the church at that point. But like you said, everyone in my family for perpetuity had been Catholic on my dad's side, not my mom's side. My mom actually was Baptist when she married my dad and converted to Catholicism. But she was never really that invested in it either. On my dad's side of the family, which is where we lived in the town where, you know, everyone in my dad's family had lived for generations upon generations, everybody was Catholic. Everyone had gone through confirmation. Everyone had done all of the things that you're supposed to do. And by the time I got to high school, I knew it wasn't for me.
Okay.
I knew it with an absolute certainty. And so by the time I got to, it was 11th grade. After my ninth grade year, I insisted that I wasn't going to Catholic school anymore. And so my parents allowed me to leave the Catholic school and go to the other private school in New Roads. Because in those days, and probably still, if you could in any way afford for your kids not to go to public school, you didn't. So I went to the other private school in the area. So I had to go to catechism classes, of course. Mm-hmm. And I went because they made me. But when it came time in 11th grade to confirm, I refused. And my mom was mad at me because she's like, can't you just do it so, you know, it'll make everybody happy? And I was like, absolutely not. I am not going in front of all of these people and church and my family and telling them I believe in something I absolutely do not believe in. So I didn't do it. I was like, I'm not doing this for you guys. I refuse. And so I did. I refused. However, later on in life, when I became a parent, which was not that much later, I had my first one at 21. I had my first daughter baptized in the Catholic Church. And I was married in the Catholic Church. You know, shotgun Catholic wedding. So, and I had to find a parish that would marry me because the one that I grew up in would not. They wouldn't marry us because I was pregnant. They were smarter than I was, apparently.
We like those first marriages. You go in and then you get out.
Then I had some neighbors, and he was an Episcopalian priest. And I mm-hmm. talked to them, and I was really conflicted because a lot of me was like, I should really do this for my kids. Like, I should try this. I should try this again. I should give it a try because I owe this to my kids. And I don't know why I thought I owed that to them, but I thought that I really owed religion to my kids. Is that weird?
No, because it's a structure, right? I mean, religion is a way to frame everything with your kids. It's the thing you can offer them as comfort when they're scared of what they don't understand. It's a shield against the monsters. It's a sword against the monsters that make it past the shield. It's an explanation for all of those big questions that come in childhood.
That's a really great explanation. And I guess, yes, that's exactly what I was thinking. But at the same time, I was like, I just can't do Catholic. I can't. And so for a while, I tried on Episcopalian. I was like, because it's Catholic light, you know?
Yeah.
And I didn't feel like they were quite as oppressive of women. And so I tried that. And then I got really invested in the whole Mary Magdalene chalice, not a conspiracy, but theories. And I started reading up into that and trying to find a way to make the female empowerment and this goddess energy that I was really drawn to fit into Christianity somehow. Yeah. But I didn't even then, and I was fully an adult. Even then, I still really didn't have the words to put how I was feeling into that. And I think it's because I was so sheltered as a child. I was so deeply steeped in the Catholic Church, and I came from such a small town like you. I didn't really know there were other options.
Yeah.
I didn't know you could opt out. I didn't know you could opt into something else. Yeah, so I tried that for a while. I even sent my kids to an Episcopalian school in Baton Rouge for a while, and I hated it every step of the way. I was a preschool teacher at a Presbyterian school when my kids were little. So I really did. I tried really hard to.
Due diligence was observed.
It was. I was going to be a Christian no matter what, even though inside I was like, I knew that this was just not who I was, but I didn't know who I was then. If I didn't have that, I didn't know who I was.
Yeah.
And so I was in culinary school. I was 36 years old. This was 2008 when I started culinary school. So I was mid-30s, getting on late 30s. My marriage was essentially over. I had gone to culinary school unbeknownst to really anybody else because I knew that I was going to need a way to support myself. I had gone to LSU. I had a degree in sociology that I never used. But I had been a stay-at-home mom, and I knew that I was going to need to be able to transition some way. And I really didn't have any, I did not know what I was going to do. But I had been, you know, working in pastry for a long time on my own, and it was something I had a passion for. So I said, okay, I'll go to culinary school. I'll do that. And it was in culinary school when I met Alec, my husband, my now current husband. He turned to me one day, and he asked me, he said, are you a witch? And I was very taken aback. I was like, my first thoughts were like, no. Why would you say that? Absolutely not. And then I sat with it overnight. And I went back to school the next day. And I was like, I think maybe I am. It was like when those words came out of my mouth and I allowed myself to kind of live that, it was like a sheet had just been pulled off of my head.
That's awesome.
And I mean, I could go on for a long time about I had a very brutal, very, very palpable awakening experience. It just so happened that Alec was already a practicing heathen. So which is my path.
Heathen is
Norse pagan.
Norse pagan. Is there a differentiation between the people who try to do like historical?
There like, are so many differentiations
versus like, hey, this is all made up sort of heathen. Because I hear the term heathen a lot these days, and I didn't hear it a few years ago, and I kind of just assume that it just means you're following the Norse pantheon, but if I don't want to make that wrong assumption, if there's, it's more nuanced than that.
It is very nuanced. There are very many different ideas of what Norse paganism is. And, you know, there are a lot of people who are not very nice people who would claim Norse paganism as their path. And I just want to put this out here right now. I am not one of those people. So if you are racist in any way, if you are homophobic in any way, and if you are disclusionary based on ancestry in any way, I am not your people.
Yeah, it's weird that there are places where basically what we consider pagan practices, like the older practices have gotten tied up with segregationist movements and ethnic cleansing movements and white supremacy movements. And I remember the first time I was like, oh no.
Yeah.
Oh no, that's not. Now, most of the times I've seen it, I understand there are also aspects of it here in the United States, but the first time I encountered that was with like Slavic region.
Yes. Yes.
Trying to reclaim their pre-Christian religion in the place where it originated. And they're using that as like a nationalistic platform. So there are people who do subscribe to every faith who are.
Yeah, for sure.
Every path has people who've taken the left-hand path.
I'm really sensitive about it because it is my path. So, yeah, and I just, definitely. And I hate that there are people that I despise so much that are go against everything I believe in that really seem to be the loud people of our path. It's sad because I tiptoe around. I don't, and I tend to be very, I'm very open. I'm very honest. I'm very outgoing. And so I'm like, ooh, hi, you believe the same things I do. Hi, my name is blah, blah, blah. And we're going to be friends now. And then it's like, no, Angie, you're not. you're not. Those are not your people. So I've learned over the years to be more cautious with how I talk about religion and who I talk about it with, especially if I think we're on similar paths, because there's a pretty good possibility that they're not going to be people I'm going to like.
Did you still feel echoes of that Catholic childhood when you found heathenism? Like, were there things whenever you finally started going to ritual and started participating in the faith that echoed back to your upbringing?
That's kind of difficult to answer, because as far as religiously, it was so freeing. And so that was, you know, almost 15 years ago. And I've never looked back religiously. Okay. I never felt a guilt about it. I never felt a longing. However, I would be lying if I didn't hearken back to some of the like precious memories from my childhood and things like the holidays, especially, and traditions that were all heavily tied to being in the church community. Easter Sunday and dressing up for Easter Sunday and egg hunts at the church and Christmas Eve mass with the children's choir and Lent, which of course we're in Lent right now. You know, we always had fish fries that our whole entire extended family would get together at our camp on False River. And so of course that was all really, really tied in to being Catholic. And so that has always been a little bittersweet for me, not having those kind of rituals to pass down to my kids. Now, we have other rituals and we have other traditions, but some of the things have necessarily fallen by the wayside through rejection of the reasons you do them.
Yeah, so if you're not going to be observing the reason for that holiday, then why do you still practice that holiday?
I guess. Exactly. Yeah. And like, you know, Lent is definitely not a thing for us. Although I do know some pagans who still observe it just as a practice in, I'm not really sure why they do it, but which it's always kind of been a mystery to me. But yeah, if you're not going to celebrate Lent, then why do you have to all get together and eat fish on Fridays?
Is there an equivalent of Lent in heathen practice? Is there like a time of fasting and a time?
No.
I know some pagan practices do have that as an aspect of their worship.
I would not say that there is like a time, a specific time to practice fasting or anything as part of ritual. However, there's one of the hugest tenets in heathenism, and it's probably almost universal throughout everybody who practices it in some way, is how Odin hung himself from the world tree for 9 days and nights in order to receive knowledge. There is reason for fasting and for self-denial in order to gain knowledge. There's the practice of sitting out, in which you literally sit out in the woods by yourself and deny yourself food and water in order to maintain a trance-like state to receive knowledge. But those are all, I think, really personal and individual practices, and nothing that is done as part of a season or a group practice. Now, there are, you know, certain Wiccan, like Gardnerians, have very, very concise ways that they practice, and the rituals that are done, even down to the wording of the rituals, are very specific. That does kind of harken back a little bit to me. And there are, of course, elements of Catholicism which can be viewed as very pagan. I mean, the saints, come on.
Are there any that you see having a place in your practice, and then you see that sort of an echo of it in Catholic practice? Like, are there any in your daily practice? I mean, I know that, like, do y'all recognize the taking of the bread and the wine? Usually it's part of the Great Rite in Wiccan practices, correct? Like, may you never hunger, may you never thirst.
Yeah, I know that's, oh my gosh. That's one of the things that I'm talking about when I refer to like Gardnerians and their rituals. And it does very much smack of almost a Catholic mass sort of situation, even if it is meant to look like something completely different. I would say for me, probably not. So one of the things that is so obvious to me that it in its pagan origins is Easter. And Christmas, for that matter. But Easter's coming up, so let's talk about that one.
Yeah.
Where do the chicks and the bunnies and the eggs, what does that have to do with Jesus and rising from the dead? It's spring fertility is what it is. And so there's a lot of overlap there and a lot of practices that were assumed by the Catholics long, long time ago because the pagans wouldn't let go of them. So they're like, that's fine. Keep your eggs, keep your bunnies and your lambs. And we're just going to call it something different.
Yeah, we'll get these guys in brown robes to come up with some really good propaganda for why this is. If you guys
are right. And that way it's easy. If you can still do the things that you love, if you can still have the things that you love, then you're willing to look the other way a little bit more. It's like, fine, we'll call it whatever you want. Just just let us keep our stuff.
Yeah.
And so we do celebrate Easter, not at all in relation to Christian Easter.
You celebrate Ostara?
Ostara, actually, heathens, there's the goddess Easter, and she is the goddess of fertility and springtime, you know, and what's more fertility than chickens hatching from eggs and lambs, because all of the baby animals are all born in the springtime.
Yeah, I had this kind of weird idea because to me, whenever I start thinking about folklore and mythology, I also think about being like a housewife in a rural area. And it's those returns on investment. And I feel like there might be something really just, there might be a practicality for Lent where if you just promise not to eat, hunt, kill anything, maybe it gives that new flock, right? Maybe it gives those little birds a chance to freaking hatch because everybody's starving. After winter, there's got to be something in the temptation to like wipe out the next generation when it's still young because you're still hungry. And I've been musing lately about like maybe that
deprivation. That is a fantastic theory. I never thought about it that way before.
Well, I like practicality with my faith. If Jesus demanded that you like hung raw meat in your house, I don't think that practice would have lasted very long in like Canada. Or where bears are really prevalent, or mountain lions, you know, there's a certain point where the demands of a faith have to align with the demands of your environment. And so it's an interesting thing. Like I was thinking about like, okay, what does Lent do? Like, what is the practicality of Lent? Why would this have stuck for so long? Because you do see like Ramadan, you do see like these periods of fasting. And whenever we would talk about Easter eggs with our kids, it was like, oh, why wouldn't you have a party when the eggs show up in the spring? You know, you've been eating stored food, you've been eating pickled meat, you've been eating, you know, stuff that's been put away, which means you're eating a repetitive diet. And dear God, these sweet golden butt nuggets are coming from the birds and they taste delicious. And so, of course, you're going to have a celebration that features that gift from nature. Anyway, that's me thinking too hard about a lot of things.
I don't think so at all. I really think a lot about the natural reasons why things are celebrated at the times that they are, that are somewhat hidden by the dogma and the, official reasons for the seasons.
I think when you look at like the Catholic people historically, Catholicism was such a defining factor for them. You know, in the Derangement, their refusal to sign the oath of loyalty, their refusal to step away from their faith. And they were never really known as like particularly pious people. Any story you hear about the Cajuns, they weren't dogmatic. They were very, you know, the church seemed almost to be like their governing body. But there were never like the Cajun witch trials. There were never people that they became so dogmatic and so tied to their religious dogma that they persecuted others. Like, if you look historically, Cajuns will usually get in trouble for like being too cool with everybody. Like in one of the states, I think it was Georgia, refused to accept the Acadians from the Derangement because they were known to be like completely fine with black people. And like, like they were going to associate with the slave population. And so they didn't like that. And so they like kicked them on. So it's kind of interesting that the Catholic people, for all that they were tied to their faith, they never really felt like they enclosed themselves in it.
Well, I think it's because it was such a way of life.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't something that they had to think about believing in. It was just the way you did things.
Yeah. But you do find within the Catholic traditions, in Cajun culture specifically, we've held on to a lot of the more fundamental, very primal parts of it. You know, we held on to, especially in prairie country, we held on to the Mardi Gras, right? We held on to that Lupercalia.
And I tell people that, especially up here all the time, us, you know, we're Cajun. We celebrate everything. We celebrate birthdays. Everything is a cause for celebration. While I've always known a lot of people who were very invested in their Catholicism and in their faith and did, you know, the pilgrimages to Medjugorje and their said their rosaries frequently, and even the vigil garden. Our church had an adoration chapel.
Okay.
So where they take shifts and they have a constant adoration. And yet I would never really describe anybody that I grew up with or who was very essentially Catholic as pious, because they're all about having a good time and
very accepting. Like I always found it was very accepting. I mean, even look what's going on right now. Like the Pope basically came out and said that they can bless gay unions. It wouldn't be a marriage, but like you're looking at now the Catholic Church being progressive in the capacity of the Catholic Church, which I like Pope Frankie. He seems pretty cool by me. I understand basically anybody who's got that level of power in today's day and age is probably going to be problematic in some regards.
Right.
But I really like Pope Frankie, and I think he's just doing his best in what's got to be a really bizarre career.
Oh, yeah, for sure. For sure. I don't know that I agree that Catholicism is particularly accepting and welcoming
compared to other faiths, other Christian faiths right now.
Perhaps, but
I don't know. Maybe I'm just trying to be optimistic. I'm kind of a Pollyanna about a lot of things.
It does sound a little optimistic to me. I guess I've always had more of a negative opinion of the Catholic Church and leadership of the Catholic Church.
Well, the Catholic Church that we grew up with isn't necessarily what I'm calling progressive. I guess I'm kind of specifically talking about like the new Pope's reign, as far as like they seem to actually be trying to pay attention to and analyze the dogma. And for a machine as big as the Catholic Church, I'm not saying that they're the Unitarians, but
it's a do or die for survival for the Catholic Church. I mean, if at some point, and it's taken them a really long time, but at some point they're going to have to modernize a little bit in order to maintain any sort of congregation throughout the world, because the world's going to move on without them if they don't.
I don't know. It's an interesting world to exist in. And I remember when I was little and sitting in the church, and honestly only half the time paying attention, because we went to church like 3 times a week. Like, there was a lot, because we went on Friday for school, and then we also had to go on Saturday. I would usually go on Saturday with my mom, and then we'd go on Sunday with my grandparents because I would spend the night. So I would be in like Catholic church like 3 days most weeks. And I don't know, there was just something about sitting in that space and in that quiet and kind of sitting with your thoughts that even when I started questioning what was being said, I still appreciated the setting. I still appreciated, I guess for me, a lot of it was about the aesthetic. I hate to say it, but like the Pinterest board of Catholicism is beautiful. Mm-hmm. Amazing.
And there is comfort in ritual. For me, I was an angsty teenager, but I wasn't looking for a reason to hate the church or to leave the church. I was looking for a reason not to. I asked a lot of questions because I wanted somebody to be able to explain it to me in a way where I was like, oh, okay, now I get it, and now I find my purpose here. And I was met with a lot of, you know, why are you questioning this? This just is. This is the way it is. And that wasn't cutting it for me.
Where do you see yourself in your current path? Like, where do you see yourself in your heathen traditions? Like, what about it welcomed you in?
I really found humanness in the gods. I really mm-hmm. found this welcoming family, I guess, sort of feeling with these gods that I view as real, quote unquote, people with flaws and strengths and personalities. And I guess that really was one of the first things that really attracted me to it. A lot of the self-reliance, I guess, that is stressed in heathenry.
Well, I guess I'm just wondering if you see the correlation between the saints, like whenever between the saints and that sort of structure, like if there's some sort of correlation.
There are, you know, gods and goddesses of specific things that have, I guess, lesser dominion, as you put it.
Well, it's not going to be a correlation. I guess it's just kind of maybe because we were raised with this idea of the saints that we're receptive yeah. to this idea of like a delegation of power that seems to come down with a pantheistic tradition. That's all I'm really getting at. I understand like deities in any path are going to be as powerful as your interaction with them, right? That energy and how you choose to interact with it. You could have a.
That is a very eloquent way of saying that. Yes. But I don't think that there is really any structure. Like even Odin is not really like the big god.
Yeah. It's not,
you know, it would be more of a family structure, I think, rather than a you know, you have God and then you've got Jesus and then you've got Mary and then you've got all of the saints who are really just really good people. Who did things that they were allowed to do and able to do through God.
Well, like if you're saying it's like a family, when you don't allow for the feminine spirit, where the heck do the kids come from? You know, when you remove that maternity, you remove the possibility. Like you never think of Mary as being God's wife.
No, you don't.
You never think of her as being like playing with baby Jesus. And then like God is sitting there and watching over them because that's who he had a baby with and this is his family. So
right.
You know, like you were saying, finding that feminine place and finding yourself in the church and finding, you know, when you found heathenry, when you found the pagan path, the fact that you saw the mother in it, you know,
you know, when it comes to Mary, I never was really able to understand or so her entire, the reasons why she's revered so much really have nothing to do with her in particular. It was her as the vessel and as the necessary to bring God's child into the world.
Yeah, like she wasn't, I remember being like really old when I realized like, oh, she was the one that was born without sin so that she was able, like the Feast of the Immaculate Conception isn't Jesus. It's that Mary was born without that stain of original sin, and that's why she was able to carry him. I think I was like past the church before I actually had that conversation that made that all click into place. So
yeah.
She's not like that was the only thing, was that she had been born without original sin, but we don't really celebrate it. That's not really something that we.
And it was nothing that she did or didn't do of her own. Like she was gifted with being born without original sin. And then she was assigned to give birth to Jesus. I mean, she was born to give birth to Jesus. She didn't
do
anything extraordinary on her own.
She didn't make choices that led to her. She's not a very proactive character in Christian mythology. She's not a very assertive woman. There are occasionally the assertive women. Actually,
right.
Super, super funny aside. I played Pontius Pilate in our passion play because all the girl parts sucked. Because my best friend got cast as Jesus. And I was like, I am not washing that feet. Like, I'm not. Like, or his face or whatever. Like, it was the woman who stops and washes his face on the way of the cross.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, I am not bathing Jonathan. That is. I want to kill him.
It's hilarious.
So they let me try out to be Pontius Pilate, and I joke that I started like the drag review of the passion play because yeah. They let me be Pontius Pilate. Like I cut my hair short and wrapped my boobs down, and then a few years later they actually let a girl play Jesus, which was amazing.
Wow.
I think I might have just been raised in like a really bizarrely progressive area of
Catholicism. I was just about to say the same thing. It sounds like it, because that was not the church that I went to.
You couldn't be the Jesus on the cross. That was naked Jesus. That one had to be a boy. But like Gethsemane Jesus was allowed to be a girl for at least a couple of years. I don't know if they still occasionally allow that. But yeah, I played Pontius Pilate because I was a better actress than the boys in my sixth grade class. I'm sure the competition was tight. But,
you know, I don't think we ever did a passion play like that.
The hardest part was always getting people to yell, "We want Barabbas, not this one," not in unison. Like, it would just, every crowd shout every year. I remember them, like, trying to get the kids to speak separately as if they were actually an angry mob. And it would just always come out like we were little cheerleaders screaming our line all at once.
A chant. "We want Barabbas,
not this one." Every year, everyone would scream the same line all together like a mob, and the poor teachers would try, and it just never worked. But it is that, you know, we talk about Easter in this time of year. You know, I was explaining to Paul the pageantry of the Easter progression. I was like, okay, it starts big. Okay, after Christmas, then we've got Twelfth Night, and Twelfth Night is the Feast of the Visitation. And then after that, then you have to start calculating the full moons and figure out when Mardi Gras starts, because it's going to start on Twelfth Night. It's going to start on the Feast of the Epiphany. We take down our Christmas tree, put up the Mardi Gras decorations, and then depending on when the full moon falls, depends on how long Mardi Gras is, right? And then we've got all the fun Lupercalian delights of Mardi Gras, and then you've got to sit there and get your ashes that are the palms from the year before and burn those and put them on your forehead, because that used to be a rite of Odin's protection that eventually the Romans just kind of went, fine, that's great. And then we've got Holy Thursday when he walks into the city, and then we've got Holy Friday, when it's the whole, ooh, that's the fun, depressing day where you do the way of the cross and you're in church all day.
Mm-hmm.
Several novenas being prayed. Novena, the rosary for every bead on the rosary. And then Holy Saturday, I think if you're like super churchy, you did stuff, but usually the Saturday was just like, yay, we're off of school and we're going to Grand Isle. And then Easter Sunday, and you wake up and, you know, he's alive and it's all amazing. And you go to the church and you wear the big dress and the giant hat and you have to wear curlers.
I was very into that part.
Oh, and I think I find a lot of people who've come to the pagan path, who paid various pagan paths from Catholicism, one of the things they appreciate about the pagan traditions is that pageantry and is that aesthetic aspect and is that sort of, you know, flowers in the church and the castle and the, like, it seems like you're in a castle. And, you know, there's a reason Hogwarts was a bunch of old churches. You know, there is something fantastical about being in a cathedral or in like a really beautiful, beautifully rendered. I mean, that was the most ornate thing. The most ornate building we were in as, you know, coon-ass country kids growing up. Like, you went to a fancy church. Like, it was fancy.
Sure.
And you can fall in love with that aesthetic. And I remember the Imbolc ritual we attended. I think it was the last one before the pandemic. They really went out of their way, like with the fire imagery and with a really well done pagan ritual is just as ornate and just as pomp and circumstancy as a Catholic service. And I do find a lot of people that started off Catholic and became pagan are like, oh my God, I just love, like, what they loved the most about the Catholic faith was that ritual sense, that repetition, that progression, and then also like just the beauty of the, that comes when you own billions and billions of dollars and probably like at least a 2-digit number of the world's real estate properties. You know,
that's really funny that you said my very favorite part of being Catholic as a child, like my ultimate favorite part, was Christmas Eve Mass.
Same.
And there was the children's choir and then the youth choir, which was the high schoolers. And so the youth choir was up in the choir loft, and the kids choir, we would be standing on the altar, and we would do a duet for the last song of the Mass before they released everybody. And it was, "Do You Hear What I Hear?" Mm-hmm. And it was like a call and repeat almost between the two. And it was so loud and so powerful and so beautiful. And that was like the last part of
Christmas Mass before you leave and go eat gumbo with your cousins.
Mm-hmm. You have to go through that right now, baby.
That was my absolute favorite part of any celebration that we ever did in
Mine
church.
Was similarly, like Christmas Eve, but we did a candlelight service and we'd sing Silent Night. And it was beautiful. St. Joseph's, it wasn't a very big church, our church when I was little. And it's not a huge church. It's just the two rows. There's no like apses on either side. It doesn't have like those extended rows of altars mm-hmm. on either side. It's just the two rows of pews. And everybody would get a candle and we would light our candles and all the lights in the church would be out for the whole service. And we'd all be holding candles through the service. Of course, I was like playing with the wax and, you know, trying to, you know, not to burn my brother. But whenever we'd sing Silent Night, and there was a man who sang in our church who was a contralto, and he could sing like 6'2" or 6'3" guy, big, big, big guy. But he was a contralto, so he had that huge, powerful, like almost soprano voice. And we would all sing Silent Night. And even as I kind of fell away from the church, I would go back to Christmas service with my family, like for that moment, for that instance. And it just feels like we're all together on that night. And I think that that's something, the parts of Cajun Catholicism that I love the best are probably in that moment, because what makes me feel Cajun is this feeling of togetherness. Mm-hmm. And I think that before I started pulling away from the church, that was one of the places where I felt that togetherness. I guess I just kind of have like one quick wrap up for you is like, do you find any conflict between your pagan path and your heathenry and like your Cajun identity? Or do you feel that they conflict, or do you feel like they complement or somewhere in between?
That's a really difficult question. Because for me personally, I don't feel like the part of me, which is, you know, my real identity as a pagan person, comes from the side of my family that is Catholic. Even though that was what I was absolutely steeped in and raised in as a child and well into adulthood. So I feel like the part of me that was called to paganism is from a different part of my family. Like the same sort of reasons why I was called to move up here to the mountains. Like it was a really palpable pulling feeling that I really needed to be up here. And then I was able to trace that through family, but through my mother's side. And so I don't really feel like it's conflicting. I still do feel very Cajun. I mean, there's no way I couldn't. That was every fiber of my day, every day of my life for the first 20 years of my life.
Angelique, thank you so much for talking to me today. This has been eye-opening. This has been a wonderful conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'd like to thank Angelique once again for sharing her perspective on our beautiful culture down here. And I'd like to thank y'all for sticking with us as we find our way through the sideways and byways of Outlandish Parish. Now, if you want to know more about us, find out about what we're up to, you can always go to outlandishparish.com. You can find the Outlandish Parish parishioners on Facebook or on Instagram. Just check out Outlandish Parish. Don't worry, next episode, Jonas is going to be back. We're going to be getting back to sort of our regular format, where Jonas and I are going to be sitting around making de veille and talking about different aspects of Cajun culture. I just felt it was important to give a little bit of perspective from a few different voices in the last couple of episodes. As always, merci to all of you for listening and for sticking with us. We want to thank every single one of our parishioners for paying attention, taking the time, and spending some time with us out in Outlandish Parish. Merci.